Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from January 17th, 2002.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, and it's the frigid high desert. My God, it's getting cold here at night. I bid you all good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever the case may be, wherever you are in all 24 time zones covered by this program. I'm Art Bell, and the program is Coast to Coast AM. Well, this is going to be a very, very interesting night, I predict. For a long, long, long time, I've been trying to get an animal communicator that I could communicate with. And hence, you could communicate with. And what we have discovered is that all roads lead to Penelope Smith as the best there is. I mean, all the other animal communicators refer constantly to Penelope Smith. So it seemed to make some sense to go to Penelope Smith. And that's exactly where we're going tonight. In the next hour. Now, in this hour, in a moment, I have for you a surprise. All right, just before my little surprise, tomorrow night is Open Lines, as I traditionally have on this program. You know, I do a great week of interviews during the week, but then Friday night, Saturday morning, it's open for anything you want to do. And as I always do every week, I would encourage any of you with any really good ideas about a special line, which, as you know, I enjoy running. The weirder, the better. To submit your idea to me in email, that would be artbell@mindspring.com, artbell@mindspring.com. And I will pluck from the submissions the very best one, and we will do something probably fairly weird tomorrow night. You should see some. One night I'm going to read to you the various suggestions that are made. I'll do that. And you can see how my selection process for whatever I do every week, you know, is arrived at. Now, he's been a friend for years and years and years. He was a one-time advisor to NASA and, of course, to Walter C. Cronkite. And he is now a movie mogul. Here is Richard C. Hoagland. Surprise, surprise. Hey, Richard.
Oh, good evening, Art.
Good evening.
You had to use the word, the M word.
The mogul word, yes.
You know, it really is fun being a mogul.
Is it?
Yes, although I've destroyed several forests since last week. Our fax machine has not stopped ringing.
All right. Well, just for those who don't know, and you've got to remember that last week, not everybody listening tonight was listening last week. So the big announcement last week was,
Richard, we have inked, as they say in the trade, a deal with a major Hollywood studio, RKO Radio Pictures.
I
love it. Radio Pictures.
Oh, yeah.
Could it be better, Art? Paul Davis and I are co-executive producers and co-writers on a project that we are keeping steeped in deep secrecy and mystery.
One in which you have, this is really important, creative control, right?
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
We have a deal, at least my part of the contract reads almost like Orson Welles' deal with RKO when he signed to do Citizen Kane.
This is going to be some movie.
It really is. We are having so much fun. We're putting the finishing touches on the script. Paul is in Hollywood, poor guy, tonight. He had to go to a Golden Globe party, and there's one tomorrow night, and the next night. And if I was actually supposed to be in Hollywood working with him.
You know, Richard, do you know how totally not my thing that is?
Exactly.
I have to get dressed up.
Oh, God, yes.
You know, in a tux, and then proceed to this automatic sort of procession. Oh, man, I hate that kind of stuff, Richard.
There is a timing.
You know, it's between that and going to the opera. You know, if I going to the opera, put a gun in my head.
I could, you know, I could do it for a little while to meet certain people. But right now, I'm in this creative mode where we're, you know, I literally worked 24 hours around the clock yesterday.
That I can understand.
And we're shipping this thing back and forth electronically with a program called Movie Magic Screenwriter. I just love these symbolically coded names for these things, which the pros use. And, you know, I code mine in one color, and he codes his changes in another color, and it's actually working extremely well. And, you know, writing is a very, to me, writing is a very solitary process. I mean, I have worked with Paul on this.
I want to talk to Paul. After this is all over, I want to talk to Paul, because I would think being writing opposite you, that'd be like Chinese torture. I mean, I can just see you getting so technical, Paul's head is swimming, and Paul trying to unravel it on the other end and sending you back a script. I can just see how this is happening.
Well, you know, as we said when we were on the show last week and we announced this, which I think politically is a really major step forward, and I'll get to a couple of affirmations of that in a minute. This is, you know, this is a fun process. This is where people live. When you think of Hollywood, you think of the big screen. Most of the major social changes of our time have occurred in movies or on television.
That's
so
true.
Mm-hmm. If you can get your foot in the door to put the message out there high, wide, and handsome, you have an extraordinary opportunity, and we're going to try to take advantage of the opportunity that we have. But you're absolutely right. When we do this back and forth, there are times when he does think that, you know, certain points I want to make sure that we get into this might be lost on the average moviegoer.
So listen to Paul, Richard.
He's listening a lot to me.
Well, that's good. But, I mean, you know, just listen to him, because, you know, it's got to be tempered. This has got to be, obviously got to be, I'm not telling you anything, it's got to be a compelling drama, as well as instructional in whatever way.
Believe me, it is compelling. It is a drama, and it will have surprises. And it's already had surprises in this process, because remember, we promised you we were going to keep everybody apprised of the process.
And that's right.
I have never done a movie before, so what I'm thinking, you know, is that this would be a really interesting way that people can find out, you know, all hype notwithstanding, how this is really done.
You know, I've got to say, scoring RKO right out of the box seems incredible to me. That's pretty big stuff.
Isn't that cool? Well,
yeah, it is.
A name is one thing, but you got people behind the name, and the people we're working with, you know, like Tom Mount, as I mentioned last week, are absolutely top drawer. Tom was, you know, president of Universal during some very creative periods in his life. Very young. You know, he's aggressive, he's imaginative, he has vision. And he and I talked, I guess, a couple of days ago, and he was telling me that the most amazing thing to him and the other folks at the studio is how many emails they have been getting. I mean, Art, everybody listens to your show. If I wanted proof of that, this has been my evidence.
Huh. So people have been what, emailing RKO?
Oh, they've been emailing tons of emails to him, because we gave out his name, and people are sharp. They basically went to the RKO website and found Tom's email address, and bingo.
I see.
He's on his way in at 6:45 the other morning, he says, you know, and his ritual, he told me, is to stop at this little place somewhere in Beverly Hills and pick up a Danish or something with coffee to take it into the office, where I guess about 7 o'clock. So he's standing there ready to pay for his Danish. And the guy across the counter looks at him and says, and I kid you not, "What's this project you and Hoagland are doing?" I mean, here is this top Hollywood movie executive.
Where is all this email coming from?
And he's wondering where all this buzz is coming from. Paul was at a party the other night, you know, like the poor party he's at right tonight, even as we're speaking. And the buzz was our picture. And this is pretty unprecedented. I actually checked with Tom on this. He said that, as far as he knows, in the industry, there has never been this amount of excitement regarding a major project where there are no stars attached to it yet, the script is not done, there's been no casting of anybody.
And you really are going to use regular people like from this audience?
We are going, well, for some of the roles. I mean, we have a lot of extra roles, and we're looking at a way to devise a just and fair process. And as I said, last week, to start with, I would like to have people who are familiar with our work, since the film is going to be based on our research into what's
right.
on the moon and Mars and
right.
out there and the government cover-ups and all that. If people haven't read The Monuments of Mars, it will kind of leave them behind the eight ball. And people are responding extraordinarily. You know, I gave out an 800 number for people who can, you know, who want to get the new signed version of Monuments.
Yes.
And that phone has been ringing off the hook.
Good.
He said, as a segue, this is the 800 number, just in case you'd like to get into the fun.
And here it is, folks.
1-800-350-4639. That's 1-800-350-4639. That will get you to some nice folks that will tell you how to get a copy of The Monuments of Mars.
Autographed.
Autographed. I will personally sit here and work my little fingers to the bone for you guys. It's a 2001 edition. It's going to be the last edition of Monuments we'll do, because the follow-on is going to be called Heritage. But I've got about 100 new pages of neat stuff and things that no one's heard about or few have heard about. About 40 pages of new images, some of the stunning imagery that Mike Malin has at great pains been forced to give us. And that will be a kind of a collector's item, you know. Now, the most extraordinary thing to me is not only that I can include, you know, folks from your audience, you know, who would like to play in the sandbox, but we've been getting resumes from professionals, a lot of top-drawer people, production people, camera people,
who would like to be involved.
Who want to be involved. I got one the other day, and I'm not going to use names now because, frankly, given what we're doing, I'm waiting for the shoe to fall, you know, the other side to do what they're going to try to do to stop this.
Yes.
But we've had some incredible resumes come through of people who are, in the industry, household names and who you would recognize if you sit and are a buff of film credits like I am. Let me give you just one example without naming a name. This guy started out with Stanley Kubrick with 2001. And his resume goes on to stunning major films all the way up to the present. He literally called me when I called him back from Universal. He was on the set at Universal working on a picture. And he not only is a pro in the industry and wants to play a key role, but he followed our research. He knew exactly what I've been doing, listening to you. And, I mean, that's the level of response we're getting. And I must say that I did not expect that. I expected a lot of ordinary folks would be thrilled and excited and interested and intrigued, and we could
get
them involved.
I think that if it's done right, it's going to be a hell of a movie, and they know that, so that's why, Richard.
Well, this guy compared this. He compared it to 2001. I mean, that's like being compared to, you know, if you're Stutz, being compared to Chrysler. It just is astonishing what we have released and what this show has been able to do, Art, in the way of exciting people. And that's what I want to continue. I want to keep everybody apprised of where we are.
Good. Well, it is exciting. Listen, we've got kind of a pretty big piece of news with regard to chemtrails.
Yes.
I want to tell people about this, so let's tell them, Richard. Chemtrails, we don't know what chemtrails are. They're jet leavens. that seem to be unlike jet leavens or contrails, if you will, of the past.
You know, a normal contrail, you'll look up in the sky, you'll see a jet, 40,000 feet, and, for a few degrees behind it.
Water vapor.
You know, like the width of your hand held out at arms, or your fist, you'll see water vapor out the back, and then it disappears. It dissipates. Chemtrails cross the sky. They crisscross. They linger. They expand. They become a haze. They don't dissipate. They're not, under any observation, normal contrails of jet aircraft. Well, the other day, information came to my attention that in October of 2001, and the reason we all missed this, of course, is because it was in the wake of 9/11, Congressman Dennis Kucinich from Ohio introduced House Resolution 2977, in the first session of the 107th Congress, in which, among other things, he seeks to ban chemtrails. Now, what's important is not that the bill, has been introduced because about only 6% of all bills introduced ever made into law are.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that in the bill's language, chemtrails are listed by definition as chemical or biological, you know, effluents that are released in the vicinity of human beings.
Now, I wonder how, Richard, he could put that in there without having some greater basis for belief that something is going on other than people who have been on this program, for example. Is that worth investigating? He must know something, eh?
Well, I think he obviously must know something because he's the first congressman out of 535 who has the conies to actually do this, to formally put in official legal language this term chemtrails, which a lot of us have been using over the last couple, 3 years. And what's remarkable is that this is in the face of complete denial by a battery of media and legal and other representative experts who claim that this is a phenomenon that does not exist, that we're all kind of crazy out here who think that there's something different about jet exhausts than in past years. So here's a congressman who's put his, you know, reputation on the line and said chemtrails are real, they exist, and they should be made illegal. Now, obviously, my first thought when I saw this was, we've got to get this guy on your show.
The representative, one more time, please.
Dennis Kucinich from Ohio. I do not know at this point. It's probably useful that I don't know whether he's a Democrat or Republican, which is kind of irrelevant.
Dennis Kucinich.
K-U-C-I-N-I-C-H.
From Ohio.
From Ohio.
That's amazing, Richard. H.R. 2977?
2977. No. October 2nd of last year, 2001.
Now, why do you think he would include language that specifically bans chemtrails without some knowledge of, you're right, I ought to get him on the show.
Yep. Well, the bill actually, in the definition section, goes into a whole bunch of other things that are dealt with on this show. For instance, it talks about mind control. All right?
It does.
Mind control is forbidden. I mean, let me give you the title of the bill. It's called, in the short term, the Space Preservation Act of 2001. And it seeks, quote, to preserve the cooperative, peaceful uses of space for the benefit of all mankind by permanently prohibiting the basing of weapons in space by the United States and to require the president to take action and implement a world treaty banning space-based weapons.
Yeah, all right. Hold on, Richard. We're at the bottom of the hour. You know, I don't for one second think that we lack weapons in space. Not for one second. Do you?
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time.
It's a wonder I can think at all.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from January 17, 2002.
By the way, I want to complain bitterly about the weather. It's going to go down to somewhere between 15 and 20 degrees here tonight. If I'd wanted cold weather, I'd have moved to a northern latitude. We're way down south here. We're near Death Valley. 15 to 20 degrees. This is ridiculous. Maybe that's what's coming our way in this great change. Who knows? Anyway, Richard C. Hoagland will be right back. Now, this is interesting. Mel in Cleveland, Ohio, and he would know, I guess, says Dennis Kucinich, the gentleman who has introduced the bill to ban chemtrails, was at one time the mayor of Cleveland in the late
70s. Oh, that's who he is. Yes, now I know.
There
now
you are.
Yes.
Yes. Richard, What do you think chemtrails are?
I think it's a global climate modification program.
So do I.
A la the paper by Edward Teller that we talked about last week.
Yeah, I think that's what it is also.
Well, he said it. I mean, basically spreading fine divided aerosols in the upper atmosphere, in the stratosphere, where they don't come down for a long time, to act as little tiny parasols to shield us from solar radiation.
You know what? The only thing that I care about, I mean, if they're doing this, then they're doing it for a good reason for the planet. We could all hope, right? All we really need to know is, what effect is this stuff going to have on us?
Exactly.
Other than that, let them have at it, as far as I'm concerned.
But Art, the corollary in representative government, as you know, the United States is supposed to be a representative government, is you're included in the decision-making loop. That's why you have, you know, when you have laws or bills put up, you have House and Senate hearings, you have open public debate, you have discussion, you have consensus, and then you're supposed to enact whatever policies, with people behind you.
I understand. But the only thing here is that if you were to make public something like this, you're doing this, obviously, as a last-ditch emergency effort to fix something that's profoundly wrong. And so not only do you have to admit the project, but the reason for it would scare the hell out of people.
Yeah, but the problem of doing it the way they're doing is that at the very time when you need an integrity of government issue to come to the fore, people trusting that their leaders really have their best interest at heart and are doing the best they can.
I would submit to you, Richard, that occasionally having the people's best interest at heart does mean keeping something from them.
Well, we didn't, in World War II, we didn't keep the A-bomb secret for a very significant period of time. It was, what, 3 or 4 years?
That's quite a while.
And that was a weapon that ultimately could have destroyed all of mankind. It still could.
It still could.
Look at Pakistan and India.
Right.
Nuclear weapons are the biggest threat we see on the horizon that man could do to other men.
Yeah, but occasionally, I will get called a CIA agent, as usual, and government and all the rest of it. I don't care. But I can see reasons and times when things are kept from the public for defendable reasons.
Yeah, well, in this case, as we discussed last week, if the reason for global warming has nothing to do with the car you drive, but is in fact endemic in the physics of the solar system,
right?
And I was intrigued that one of your guests this week, I've been up late writing, so who do I listen to? God, thank God, there's a friend of mine on the air who's got good guests.
Yes,
he mentioned that this was going on all over the solar system. In addition to planets that we'd mentioned last week, he threw in a few more in the pot. I think he said Saturn was brightening and other places are changing.
Oh, yes.
So if this is endemic to the whole solar system, as the hyperdimensional model says, then this chemtrail thing is a desperate stopgap measure that really is not adequate to the task. Now, the reason you would do that is because you don't know any better. That you don't understand the physics of the cause, therefore you cannot even begin to think of the physics of the solution, because you are a tightly closed in-group that doesn't get any information coming in from the outside, that makes policy in a vacuum, and is doing dumb, stupid stuff because you're not bringing in people that might show you how to do right, non-stupid stuff. You see what this is why you need a public discussion and debate. The Founding Fathers were not dummies. They understood that public policy that is formulated in a back room can sometimes go radically awry because it doesn't get the right expertise coming into the room to say, wait a minute, guys, do this as opposed to that.
Okay, but again, I really do say that if it was something that radical for which we're seeking or attempting a remedy, then I understand why they wouldn't make it public. I really do. I understand that we would all like the public debate, but there'd be more than that, Richard. There would be public panic.
And when it unravels, when they are found out,
yes,
all right, then what happens?
I don't know.
Not only do you have the problem hasn't gone away, But you now have another problem.
Well, if they have affected the problem, then they're geniuses. If they have done nothing to affect the problem, and it's really as bad as some of us imagine, then they're political dead meat. I mean, what it comes down to. They're either heroes or they're...
The key thing I see is this concept of public trust. Remember my mind is going, you know.
And I don't mean to defend all this much secrecy in our government, because they really, really overdo it. I mean, they've got things secret that are idiotic. So I don't mean to get over on that side of
the park. Stamps have run out of control.
That's way out of
control.
And
there is a definite CYA operation in terms of classifying things under national security.
Sure.
Whenever bureaucracy now doesn't want to be embarrassed, it puts a classified stamp on something, therefore no one can get at it.
That's right.
So you have this runaway, and you know, Steve Bassett has talked about this at great length on your show, that we need to redo or reassess or rethink the national security state that we got into back in 1947, because with the Cold War over and the threats of a totally different nature, these kinds of public policy issues need to be publicly discussed. Now, suppose we are confronting this huge change of the physics of the solar system that is adversely going to affect us here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
How long can you keep it secret? You know, at some point, you know, the mainstream is going to get wind of it. And as I said before, when they find that government has lied to them, look at the Enron thing.
Well, they already are.
Look at the Enron thing.
Well,
the anger is not that Enron went bankrupt. The anger is that a few people basically made lifeboats for themselves and let everybody else sink with the Titanic,
mm-hmm.
while telling them everything was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read those Enron,
every day, Richard. I read about Enron every day.
Yeah, well, that's a minuscule example of what could blow up in their faces on something like this.
I don't disagree with you, but I also say there is a good argument on the other side, Richard, and you would... You know, they've done studies, as you know, and I think they're still valid. If something was really profoundly wrong and there wasn't much being done about it, or that could be done about it.
Yeah, but that's an assumption. That is a definite assumption.
But it's an assumption based fairly soundly on the desperate effort you're describing to affect.
No, what that tells us is that the folks who are making the decisions don't know anything else to do. Doesn't mean there's nothing else to do. It just means that they don't know of other options. And it may be because the left hand is not talking to the right hand.
Okay, let me try something here.
Okay.
With your knowledge, what would you do?
In terms of changing
if you knew that the physics was beginning to change, that every planet was being affected, that ours was going to be affected, what would you do?
Well, a global temperature rise...
Or am I asking you about a movie plot here?
No, not really.
Okay, all right.
A global temperature rise of this magnitude, solar system-wide, obviously not confined just to Earth, tells us that it's something that's big.
Hmm.
And it's if it's based in this physics, the first thing you'd have to do is to figure out how to work with the physics, make technologies that could use this physics to, for instance, change the local heat balance in various regions of the Earth.
Hmm.
Now, who might have that expertise now that has been working with this physics for the last 50 years? If, as I said last week, the thing that...
How about the government vault where they took Tesla's stuff?
Yeah, exactly. In other words, I'm talking about the military, you know, industrial black projects folks,
mm-hmm.
who are not talking to the public policy folks. By definition, the things they've been working on are so top secret that it's, you know, burned before reading. So if you have, as Cool Hand Luke said, a failure to communicate... Government's left hand doesn't know what the right hand is. I mean, the president is sitting there. He is not aware of everything this government has ever done or knows how to do. And I would be betting dollars to Navy beans that the cabinet doesn't either. That even people like the head of the EPA or, you know, the Secretary of the Interior is not aware of these deep black military projects that have been using this physics. And how do I know? Because I come back, Art, to what you said to a guest earlier this week. In fact, it was my old friend David Brin, you mm-hmm. had on the air the night following me last week.
Right.
He claimed that, there'd be nothing ever covered up and scientists would be irascible.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, you never asked him the simple question, What happens if they sign a secrecy oath and can go to Leavenworth if they talk? You know, I don't care how irascible you are, spending the rest of your life in a federal pen is not something that somebody is going to do willingly if they've signed an agreement to get in on the good stuff, to be part of the in crowd. So,
well, he's like my friend Seth Shostak. You know, everything's a half full glass of water. That's the kind of guy he is. That's all right.
But his point was that these kind of technologies are so exciting that at some point someone's going to spill the beans. And my point was, or is, that, yeah, unless you sign an agreement where they can put you away for life if you do spill the beans, and maybe take other measures to make sure that you don't, you know, give in to that tendency. So if we are confronted with a huge global problem, like warming because of an intrinsic physics that the mainstream of physicists at Caltech and MIT and whatever are not even aware of, things that go back to where Maxwell deviated 100 years ago, as we've said on this show. And the only people who do understand that are a tiny group working with super toys like you had fly over you there in out there in the desert.
Right.
The only way then to get that information out to solve the problem is to break it out of the black hole, to get it into public view. But, of course, that's not going to happen because we have enemies, and the military mind is to, you know, classify things forever. A secret is a secret is a secret. So when you have a compartmentalized society where, again, the left hand does not know what the right hand knows, you are setting yourself up for a situation where when you're confronted by this kind of a problem, you don't have the wherewithal to solve it.
Well, Richard, it's not within the system, unless they've found the solution with what they're doing here, to do this. It's just not. I mean, the government lives on secrets. It is based on secrets. The entire underpinning of the government is all about secrets.
But that's only now. It didn't used to be.
They've always kept secrets, Richard.
Yeah, but not officially setting up a subversion of the Constitution, which happened in 1947 with the National Secrets Act. At that point, we took another trail. And what people like, you know, Steve and others have been arguing, and, you know, our old friend Stephen Greer is arguing, is that it's time to rein it in, that we're basically going to commit suicide if we keep going down this trail where, you know, various small groups know more and more about less and less and cannot talk to each other. And that's why Kucinich's bill, I mean, let me read you a couple examples of the things that he tackled.
Oh,
in this
by
bill.
All means, please do.
All right, I have the specific language here. By the way, for people who want to actually go and read the language themselves and prove to themselves that we're not making this up.
Yes.
You go to the Thomas Register, which is http://thomas.loc.gov. Thomas.loc.gov.
Okay.
And you simply type in the bill that you want.
H.R. 2977.
2977.
Okay.
And that will take you directly to the bill.
Read, Richard, read.
Okay. In the bill, he covers things such as, I mean, this is pretty astonishing. Let me go down to the specifics here. Okay. The term weapon and weapon system mean a device capable of any of the following: damage or destroying an object, whether in outer space, in the atmosphere, on the earth, by firing projectiles, detonating explosives, directing a source of energy, including molecular or atomic energy, subatomic particle beams, electromagnetic radiation, plasma, or extremely low-frequency or ultra-low-frequency energy, inflicting death or injury on or damaging or destroying a person or the biological life, bodily health, mental health, physical, and economic well-being of a person, through use of land-based, sea-based, or space-based systems, using radiation, electromagnetic, psychotronic.
My God, Richard, that
psychotronic, laser, or other energies directed at individual persons or targeted populations for the purpose, get this, of information war, mood management, or mind control.
Mind control. You know, Richard, they've covered almost every active endeavor I've imagined the government is doing there. Yeah.
You got to get this guy on the show, and I now clearly remember him. He's a bright, young, aggressive guy, and boy, does he have kahunas to do this.
Well, I sure would like to know, what he bases some of this on. In other words, what his beliefs are, and specifically what knowledge he has. Or if he doesn't have specific knowledge, then what made him decide to write all this in? Fascinating. Sure, I'd love to talk to him, yeah.
Such terms include exotic weapon systems, such as electronic, psychotronic, chemtrails. There it is.
Chemtrails.
Chemtrails. No, this guy is onto something. He's finally decided that something is rotten in Denmark, and as a representative of his constituency, he put the bill in. As I said, 6% usually get into law, so 94% don't make it. So obviously the next step I would see is you have him on the show, and you, this audience, if they're interested and concerned, they ask him a bunch of questions, and then they provide evidence of support for this bill to his colleagues, and that's how you get the job done. We get a public discussion as to why we need this exotic, you know, weapon system.
But I mean, chemtrails, for one thing, is a new phrase altogether, and I can think the military would sidestep that one real easily. I mean, they would call what they have, a climate modification dust, you know, or something, mil-spec dust. Whatever it is, they would call it something else. So to ban this without having agreement on what chemtrails are is kind of a reach.
Which gets back to the public discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, you're right. I should have this man on the air. People in Ohio, call Dennis Kucinich or write him or fax him and tell him Art Bell wants to have him on the air. Let's see what happens.
Excellent.
How's that?
Excellent.
Yeah, I'd love to ask him some questions. That's remarkable, Richard.
Isn't that? You know, there is progress. Now, remember what I said about the reason I'm so excited about this movie is not because I'm going to meet Julie Roberts someday, but because... Can you imagine the political lever and the congressman we can acquaint with a constituency that believes in the viability of asking questions about what's on the moon and Mars that they haven't told us about?
Yes.
This is a demonstration that enough people got to at least one representative, an honest guy, that he finally decided to do something.
Well, either that or he did it on his own because that's what he believes.
Well, but he had to have information coming from somewhere. I mean, for all we know, he listens to you every night.
Anything is possible.
It sure is.
All right, listen, brother, we got to go.
Okay.
Thank you, as always, Richard. You will be back soon.
I guess so.
RKO Mogul. See you later, Richard.
You too.
Bye. We'll be right back.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. But she lets me down every time. Can't make her mine. She's no one's lover tonight. With me, she'll be so inviting. I want her all for myself. When we're all alone, keep it up, girl. Yeah, you turn me. Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from January 17, 2002.
Well, here's something I've been waiting to do for a long time. I have interviewed quite a number of very pleasant people who claim to be animal communicators, and I'm sure are. But I've never been satisfied with the program that we've done. I don't know why. Tonight, I have a feeling we're headed in the right direction. All lines point to Penelope Smith. And whatever animal communicator you might have on, or somebody who knows about this subject, this is the name that comes up, is Penelope Smith. Now, as you know, and I'm going to apologize for it ahead of time, we are a cat household. We have four cats. One wild cat, I won't go through the menagerie here. One very wild cat, he's still wild, you know. He's kind of cool with me, but he's generally otherwise totally wild, completely wild, and always will be, save what he and I have worked out together, and we've worked out a lot. Anyway, I've always wanted to know what animals think about, what animals think. I don't know, what they think of us, what they think of their environment, what they think of when they're having fun, what they dream about. I've always felt and feel now that, you know, knowing my four cats as I do, that they have absolute distinct snowflake-like personalities. And I use the snowflake analogy for a reason. Because that's how humans are described. We're all little individual snowflakes, right? Well, so are they. And so I have believed for a long time, contrary to what many people believe, that animals have souls. I believe that too, in case you're interested. Convinced they do. But beyond that, I don't know a lot of what they think about themselves, their fellow animals, human beings, God, the whole environment. And so here comes Penelope Smith. Communicating with animals telepathically throughout her life, Penelope Smith discovered in 1971 that animals could be relieved of emotional traumas and other problems through the same counseling techniques that help humans. The training and experience that have contributed to her success and her educational background, with bachelor's and master's degrees in social sciences, years of training and experience in human counseling, nutrition, holistic body energy balancing methods, research into animal nutrition, anatomy, behavior, and care, plus the first-hand education from the thousands of animals she has contacted. Penelope's visionary work has been featured in newspapers and magazine articles, numerous books, radio and TV, in the U.S. and all over the world. As a leading pioneer in this field, she has developed tried and true telepathic communication techniques which complement current scientific knowledge and traditional methods. Her methods foster people's ability to understand and communicate with animals on all levels, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. She is the world's leading teacher of basic and advanced interspecies telepathic communication and has helped launch the careers of numerous professional animal communicators. Penelope feels that the sacred connection we make through telepathic communication with other species is essential for human wholeness. She believes that everyone is born with the power to communicate with other species, that although it is a long-lost thing for most people, it can be regained for the benefit of all beings on Earth. Coming up in a moment, Penelope Smith. Penelope Smith, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Where are you?
I'm in Point Reyes, which is northwest of San Francisco.
Okay. You have been doing this, is it fair to say longer than anybody else in a contemporary sense?
Pretty much. There's a few others who started about the same time that I did.
Since you were first out of the chute, or near first, maybe you can tell me how it happened.
Well, for me, I've always communicated with animals and never lost the ability. I never fell under the grip of socialization and denied that animals were intelligent, feeling beings. And I just kept up my communication, but I kept it quiet. I never knew when I was younger that this would end up being a career and that I would be teaching people
okay.
how to
so,
do this.
In other words, then, there was never a time you couldn't do it. There was
right.
no incredible moment when suddenly the mind's, you could always do it.
Yes, I could. I was always aware of being able to communicate with animals.
Huh. How did that, as a matter of curiosity, when you were very young, how did that manifest itself? I mean, after all, you must have said to mom or dad something or another, right?
Well, my mother discouraged me and told me I had a very active imagination. So I just, again, kept it between me and the animals because I had such an intimate connection with them, and I used to talk to the birds and the butterflies and the snakes and all the critters, and I felt so close to them. I didn't want to lose that. I also had a very turbulent family. And my best friends actually were my animal friends, both wild animals and domesticated animals. So I wasn't about to cut them off and deny their intelligence.
So they actually represented the stability in your life then?
To a great extent, and my spiritual connections.
That makes sense. No, that makes absolute sense.
And that is the way it is for a lot of people who are very close to animals. They had very close bondings when they were young and took care of animals, and animals took care of them.
Mm-hmm. Since there was no point where it actually began, I can only ask you in a general sense, in what way you communicate with animals. What comes back to you? Is there an actual communication, or is there sort of a knowing? If you ask a question or make a query, or do animals just occasionally speak up to you on their own? You see what I'm asking?
Like, yeah, I do. It's just like communicating with you, only without the human language. I listen to them. I open to them. I communicate to them. They get what's behind my words if I speak in words. They get the thoughts and the feelings behind the words. And what I get from them are all what I call telepathy is like internal feelings. It's like your internal senses. And so what I get back from them are images, feelings, thoughts, all of which I translate into words.
Right.
So it's all the senses internally received from the animal, which gives me an insight into their world. In fact, I can feel what they feel, sense both physiologically and emotionally what's going on with them, feel how they see the world, even see how they see, hear how they hear.
Mm-hmm.
So that's real deep telepathy is the deepest connection is when you actually, it's like becoming the animal, becoming one with them.
All right. You said you have communicated with snakes.
Yeah, all kinds of animals.
Just as a matter of curiosity, how does the snake think about the world and see the world versus, say, a dog? How great a difference is there in the way they perceive?
There's a lot of difference among species and among individuals. So let's say you're comparing a snake and a dog.
Right.
A snake has whole different senses than a dog does and a whole different experiential feeling about the world. Snakes are generally not domesticated, although there are domesticated snakes. So they're wild animals, and dogs are generally domesticated. And so they pick up a lot of the environmental cues from people, and they start even thinking like people and responding like people the more they're around people because they have to get along with people. So a snake and a dog, there's a lot of difference in the way they think. So let me kind of take you into their world.
Please.
You go, you experience a snake. Say you're sitting with them in the woods or wherever, or even a snake that is in somebody's aquarium. You sit with them, they perceive and feel the world very differently than a dog. So they're not so oriented. Well, dogs are oriented, of course, very much by their smell, but dogs also have very keen hearing, touch in a different way, and they have a whole different compilation of senses. So a snake doesn't respond in the same way. The snake is feeling and sensing in, like a lot of reptiles sense, very electrically. They hear very keenly, but they also sense energy, almost like electricity. They can experience heat, even from pretty far distance. And so when you're coming up to them, they're not so much looking at you, although they can see, that isn't their main sense. They're experiencing you as an energy form, and they get your intentions. Now, all animals get your intentions. All animals, whatever form, from slugs to elephants, can perceive intentions coming toward them. And by intentions, I mean what it is you're feeling toward the animal, what it is you want to do. It's not necessarily what you're verbalizing, but what your energy is projecting out. So if you have an aggressive energy and your intention is to kill the snake feels that as an impact. They actually feel it coming toward them, and they may not even necessarily know it's coming from a human or a dog or whatever because they may not perceive that, but they feel that intention strong and clear, and
gotcha.
So they start to react to it.
Gotcha. Defensive, immediately.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's, like, you can describe, like, I've been with a lot of different animals and experienced them deeply, how they feel, how they think, and you can go inside their world, and then there's their individual, also when you get comfortable with them and they're comfortable with you, and you can ask them questions about their world, that's another different experience, because they all are spiritual beings, again, in different kind of bodies, with different kind of body forms, so they have whole different experiences of the world, but they all seem to share this sort of spiritual undercurrent of connection and understanding sort of the basics of life, in some ways better than we do, because we tend to forget and get lost in our mental complexity.
Sure we do. Here's a wild one for you. Human beings generally, at least in the West for sure, consider cats and dogs to be the very best domestic partners. In the animal world, is that also true? Do cats and dogs think of humans in the same way as the best partners to have from another species? Or are there other animals in the animal kingdom that might make equal or even better companions to humans?
Okay, so this question is a generality, and not every cat or dog would respond in the same way. So I would say,
sure,
I can't make an overall statement, because you'll get different things from different cats, depending on their situation. Many domesticated animals, cats and dogs, really love to be with people. In fact, most of them have as their basic purpose in life to be a family member, to help people, to comfort them, to be in the family of people. Long ago they made this decision to come into the lives of people.
Did they?
Yes. Or they wouldn't be there. They wouldn't have stayed there. You know, it isn't like we're captivating them. There's plenty of them that can go, they can go wild. Well, now we've domesticated them,
sure,
so much that they're dysfunctional without our help.
Right.
But for the most part, okay.
My generalized question really was...
But I can give you some varied answers from various animals that will give you sort of a broad spectrum. I can't give you one answer.
I guess I'm asking, let me try it like this. Would you say that there are a lot of goats or koalas or some other sort of species out there that's sort of saying to itself, you know, damn it, what's with this dog and cat thing? We'd be really good with humans, you know, we'd be good with humans, and we're just rejected.
There's nobody that's going, we're rejected. If they want to be with humans, they gravitate to humans, and humans end up gravitating to them. Everybody's telepathic, whether humans are aware of it or not, and they get the messages, they get the feelings, and they gravitate to each other. So, no, there's nobody out there going, oh, poor me, because if they wanted to be with humans, they gravitate to humans. Even dolphins who want to be with humans, or other animals who want to be with humans. I've had fish follow me in the water, even wanting to come out of the water with me because they get so close to me.
Really?
Yes. I've had a lot of different experiences of animals wanting to be close. When you connect with them, they almost forget about your species. When you really, truly connect, you drop the negative intentions toward them. You drop the fact that humans are often step on animals and push them out of the way. Mm-hmm. If you just sort of get into a quiet space with animals and be with them, they pretty soon drop the fear and the fact that you are human and a different species and start communicating to you as a fellow being. Now, they, again, have totally different viewpoints of the world, which you can learn from enormously. In fact, that's what our ancestors and tribal peoples all over the world emphasize, is that we can all learn from each other because we all have different qualities to give to each other.
Can I ask you about stepping on animals?
Yes.
I have four cats, and, you know, inevitably, in a 24-hour day, 7-day week, once or twice a month, one of my poor little cats will get its tail stepped on. And, of course, they screech bloody murder. I mean, they, what does a general friend of yours, and our cats are very good friends of ours,
yes,
is it mentally cussing you out in that moment of screech?
It depends on the cat, but I'll tell you, just like us, they respond, you know, they have pain, they respond with, hey, that hurts.
Yeah,
now, some cats will go look at you and go, hey, did you do that deliberately? Other cats will go, oh, that's my clumsy human.
Uh-huh.
It depends on how they tune into you. Some will tune into your thoughts and go, oh, they didn't mean it. And others will go, hey, wait a minute. Are you just not paying attention to me? Each one will be different. So it's fun to listen to them because they each have their own different quality of communication and their own personalities. So, you know, each one might answer differently to the same thing.
They absolutely have. I have four cats, and mm-hmm. their personalities could not be any more different than four people that you would just, you know, pluck from the street with
individual
snowflake little personalities. I mean, they are all absolute individuals.
Definitely. And every being is, whatever species they are. It's only human blindness. You know, people go, oh, well, all the fish are the same, all the snakes are the same. When you start to communicate with them, you realize they're each unique. You have to get your perceptions open to be able to perceive it. You know, and you've lived with your cats, you've observed them, you've loved them, they're your family members, so you start to see how they are individual. But somebody else coming along would say, oh, it's just a bunch of cats.
All right, well, even a lot of pet owners only regard their pets with so much respect. Now, I'm sort of curious, when somebody with your level of telecommunication ability, telepathic ability to talk to an animal, talks to an animal that's never been, you know, immediately telepathically communicated with as directly as you're able to do it, does the animal sort of take a, oh my God, you know, it's kind of like having a dog talk to you for the first time or something?
They usually know right away. They know when you come into a room, they know that you can pick up their thoughts. They know right away that the channel's open, that you're not just unconscious or in your own thoughts, that you're aware of them and can receive them. So there's only been a few that I've met that have been, like, taken aback because they were so focused on something else. But most of the time, animals are very alert.
You know, like suddenly, oh, my God, this one's speaking cat. Hold on, Penelope. We're at the bottom of the hour. I'm Art Bell. My guest is Penelope Smith.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
Penelope Smith is here, and it's about to get pretty wild. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to ask a lot of specific questions from the best person in the world to answer them. Maybe some will not have answers, but we're going to get pretty specific about what animals think. And what I want you to do is fast blast them to me. And there's two good reasons for you to go to my website right now. After I get a little sax here, I'll give them to you. All right, here they are. Number one, the first hour, we discussed the Space Preservation Act of 2001 by this representative in Ohio. And if you'll go to What's New on my website, we've got the text for you if you want to read it. It's under What's New, first item, Hoagland Space Preservation Act 2001. Read it. It's amazing, absolutely amazing. It'll blow you away. Item two what is item two? Item two is that you should go to Fast Blast, also on the website. How do you Fast Blast me? You go to Program and then Fast Blast to Host, and if you have a specific question that you would like me to ask Penelope about animals, not a specific animal necessarily, but about animals, then fast blast it to me and we will fit it in. All right, so coming up in one moment, Penelope. You know, in the next break, I may try and take a real close-up picture of Yeti. Yeti is our latest cat here, and he's really something. He's about a mile long. He's this incredible cat. Anyway, I'll try that in the next break. Penelope, welcome back.
Thank you.
I've got just a million questions. This is from one person. One, do most cats prefer to live alone, meaning alone with human beings, or do they prefer to have a cat pal in the house?
Again, every cat is different. You will get some cats that absolutely say, I am the only cat here and my people only need me. And there are other cats that totally enjoy the company of another cat or multiple cats. And it varies from cat to cat.
They have serious troubles with jealousy, don't they?
The jealousy, even that word, is kind of a projection from human emotion. And mm-hmm. a lot of what people call jealousy is their own thoughts ricocheting into the cats, because people kind of install that into cats. Cats can compete with each other over space, over people. But what happens when people, this is very common, people will go, oh, my cats are jealous. The cats right away pick up what this is. And they'll be fine when the people aren't there. And as soon as the people come, the cats will pounce on each other and start dramatizing this whole jealousy thing. And the more people put that into the space, the more the cats pick it up, or dogs, or whoever it is, and they start to create it. As soon as you drop that and you praise each one and admire each one and thank each one for who they are and what they do with each other, they start to act quite differently. So I feel like people, while cats definitely can be competitive and experience feelings like jealousy, I feel a lot of this is pumped up by people. I've experienced this again and again, and can be handled very well by handling the people who are constantly thinking jealousy, jealousy, jealousy.
Interesting. How do we select a cat that will like us and be happy with us? And my answer to that, before you answer, is all my cats have selected me.
Yeah.
Actually, that's the absolute truth. I have not selected them.
And that's the best way to go.
But a lot of people do go out and select an animal. You know, they go to a shelter or whatever. And
it needs to be a mutual process of really tuning in and seeing who's meant to be with each other. And I feel the best is just what you said, is they come up to you, they look at you. Sometimes people go, oh, I want the one that's the pink with the purple eyes or whatever it is. And it's the one with the brown stripes that is calling to them. Take the one with the brown stripes, because they know animals are so tuned into what their purpose is with you, how they gravitate to you, what their life is going to be like with you. They're in a lot of ways more tuned in and sensitive to those kind of energetic connections that we are, until we take the time to do it and to slow our minds down.
Well, here's one for you. I had a cat for a very short while named Ghost, and we named him Ghost because we found him under our house. You know, people dump pets. They do
mm-hmm.
that. Ghost was wild. Ghost was... unfortunately, I took Ghost in to get all the shots and all the usual stuff, and Ghost turned up to have feline leukemia, and Ghost had to be put down, and I was inconsolable. Oh, God, I cried and cried. And so I went to the cat shelter, and I thought I would console myself by seeing what was there. And we went, Ramona and myself went to six different giant cages, you know, like with 40 or 50 cats in them each. And we got to this final one, about the fifth or sixth one, and here comes this little black girl cat running across, just like a streak. She ran across. She ran up my pants. This is the truth.
I know.
Came up, threw her paws around.
They know what they're doing.
Threw her paws around my neck and wouldn't let go.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, well, guess this is it, you know. And she's been that way every night, every day since. She sleeps in bed with me, under the covers with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sweet. Well, see, you were smart and tuned in and accepted this love and this connection. I mean, I wouldn't do anything but that, but be tuned in and listen to what the animals have to say, because they know what they're doing.
Joe asks now, is it unreasonable to keep cats indoors through their lives?
Again, every cat is individual. There are some cats that are very happy being indoors and some cats that are not. So you have to kind of work it out. Sometimes it can be a compromise. Well, even when you're living in a city, you can create a window box for a cat
so
they can at least go out and smell the fresh air and see the birds.
No, but I think people are generally asking, some people let their cat out and let it roam and go anywhere it wants and do anything it wants. Usually
right.
they end up sadly getting squished by cars or eaten by coyotes out here.
Exactly.
But
many cats can be happy as indoor cats. There's thousands, millions of cats who are indoor cats and doing very well and living very happy lives. Of course, they have to have their needs met for exercise, for stimulation, for love, for connection.
All right, here's the political hot one. Are cats likely to be damaged psychologically if their front claws are removed?
Yes. In most cases, what happens is, and I've interviewed a lot of cats who have had their claws removed, it's extraordinarily painful and leaves the cat, it's a huge trauma to a cat. It's like taking the first joints off your fingers and leaves the cat very sensitive. So often cats who have had this trauma inflicted upon them, they become biters. They feel very defenseless. They feel hostile. They have a lot of anger. I've taken cats and worked them through the trauma so that they stop biting people after that because they have such trauma. So I would say, in general, decline is very, very traumatic to cats. Not always, but in most cases.
If it's going to be done, I presume it should be done when the cat is extremely young, kind of like we... I don't know, various rituals that are performed on even people, done when you're very young so you don't remember the pain, eh?
It isn't a matter of you don't remember the pain. The pain is in the body. And so even a young cat can feel that trauma. But it depends. Everyone will take it differently. Sometimes people can't even keep a cat because they're so wild. If they don't declaw them, they can't even, provide a home for
them.
That's
correct, yes.
So sometimes it's the best option. At the same time, there are things that you can do to make it easier for them if you have to do such a traumatic operation.
Well, when I was, days old, to tell a big secret, I was circumcised. But you know what? I don't remember it, thank God.
Right.
And wouldn't it be somewhat the same if a cat's very, very young?
Again, even if you didn't remember it, it's still lodged in your cells and may have some effect on you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Here's James from Cedar Falls, Iowa, who asks, I had an experience where I swear I witnessed my dog crying after he nipped my finger. Can a dog be sad to that degree? That it really cries.
Yeah, the physiological mechanism of crying, of course, is very human. At the same time, yes, dogs can have deep, deep sadness. So they moan, they cry, they oftentimes will take on a human expression because they live with humans. But it isn't a matter of that they don't have the feelings. They can have great feelings of grief, of pain, of feeling sorry for things, definitely.
All right, here's someone taking issue with you. Carmine in Milwaukee says, Art, Penelope makes some really interesting points, but I have sat with extreme intent on killing a white-tailed deer, then done so, and the deer doesn't react in any way unless it senses me through some normal channel.
Mm-hmm. And many people hunt and hunt with intention not to hurt the animal, but to actually kill and eat them. And this has been a long history of people with animals. Animals know that they're prey. I mean, they're animals that are killed by owls and other foxes and other animals. And they aren't necessarily afraid if your intention is simply to be present with them and you have some kind of agreement with them to take their life. Now, I don't know what this person is doing when they're being with the animal.
I've heard that before, that there is some kind of agreement between that animal and the hunter to have the life taken with the intent of being eaten. It's pretty weird to think about, but
I'll give you an example of that with other animals. I saw this program. It was quite wonderful, called Wild America, years ago, Marty Stauffer.
Of course.
And he showed a mountain lion killing a deer, and the deer, then the mountain lion lay down with the deer and was licking the deer and pawing the deer, and the emotion that was coming from the mountain lion was gratitude, love, deep expression of thankfulness, similar to what Native American peoples have said you always have to be when you're hunting, if you're going to, you know, take an animal's life, to be grateful, to ask them. And the mountain lion and the deer have a pact with each other. It's an understood pact. Now, every animal will try to survive. Every animal wants to, you know, have their body carry on. At the same time, they also know that they're going to die and accept death as part of their life. I'd like to give you another story, something I learned from an animal who was a prey animal. I was teaching in Germany, and we were in this barn that had a lot of horses and a lot of rabbits. And the rabbits were all in these very spacious cages. They were food rabbits. And I said to the rabbit, "How do you feel about your life?" And he said, "My life is so good here. I'm well taken care of." He had beautiful straw, great roomy cage. "The people love me. And unlike the wild rabbits, I know when I'm going to die, and I don't have to worry about it. I'm provided for. It's very wonderful here. I spend my time meditating and being filled with love all around me. And I wouldn't want to be a wild rabbit." And I said to him, "Yeah, but you're going to be killed to be eaten." And he said to me, "Everybody gets killed to be eaten. You're going to be killed to be eaten." And I said to him, "Well, wait a minute. No, I'm not going to be eaten." He says, "No, you will be eaten. Everybody is eaten." And I got what he meant. He looked at the horse. He looked at me. He says, "Everybody's eaten." He totally accepted that there's a natural cycle of life, that we're all going to get eaten one way or another, our bodies will, and that he goes on. And there wasn't a problem there. I'm not saying that this justifies killing all animals or whatever. This isn't a matter of justifying. It's a matter of tuning in, seeing what the cycle of life is, and realizing that animals do eat each other, and that's, you can do it in a way, if you are going to do that, eat animals, you can do it in a way that's honoring and, as that hunter experienced, very untraumatic. You don't do it in a way that's hurtful and torturous of the animal.
What do dogs and cats think of TV?
Again, different ones, different things. I had one cat who watched basketball games, and he watched that ball go back and forth, back and forth. And then I've had people tell me that when I have been on TV, that their animals run inside. I had a program that played again and again in Northern California, and their cats and dogs run inside to watch the TV. And then other people say that certain animals have favorite programs. And frankly, I've experienced a lot of different thoughts from different animals. Some could care less about the TV. Others enjoy it because their people enjoy it. Some actually have favorite programs.
Well, here's one for you. I have a truly wild cat. I mean feral, flat out feral. It was 6 months before I could touch this cat without a glove on my hand. This is how feral this cat was, starved to death. Another one dredged out from beneath my home that just got abandoned. And he's fat and sassy now, but he's still as feral as he ever was, except with me.
Mm-hmm.
I would go in every day with a big jacket on and gloves and protective gear. And, you know, I would sneak up and try to pet, you know, and this cat would go like that.
Exactly.
This cat had to live 6 months in our bathroom because it wasn't safe.
Yeah.
It just wasn't safe. Anyway, he's okay now, except around anybody else except me and, mm-hmm. and my wife.
Mm-hmm.
But particularly me. Now, get this. He's afraid of people on TV.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just afraid of people. He's afraid of people on TV.
I can understand.
And the minute the TV comes on and people come on TV, he looks at them, he hears them.
Yeah.
He's gone.
Yeah.
We call him Comet.
Yeah.
So.
And he's super sensitive to energies, super sensitive to any threat in his environment, and he's definitely made his choices about what he wants in his life.
Yeah. And now, interestingly, since coming into the house, he doesn't want anything to do with going out, not even on the porch. I mean, mm-hmm. he will sit out there and try to get in the door and figure out how to get in the door and cry. He doesn't even want to be away.
Yeah.
This house is his world.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't care one whit for anything outside of it.
And you respect that, and that's great.
Well, I try to take him out for a little sun, and he just cries to get back in again, you know?
Yeah.
Todd in Santa Rosa, California says, my parents have a golden retriever that smiles. People think he's snickering, but we know much better. We explain it to them, and then people are okay with it, but this dog smiles.
Yeah, there's quite a few that do.
It's true.
Yeah, there's quite a few that do. And again, some of this is adaptation and what people have encouraged in the animals, and they pick it up and they try to do what humans do. Now, they feel smiling. I mean, animals feel joy. They feel happy. And then they learn to express it in very human ways. And that's the best a dog can do, is kind of curl up their lips. So some people think it's a snarl, but obviously with this golden retriever, and I've seen it with other dogs, it's a smile. And you can feel it. I mean, you can feel their energy is happy.
Can they actually do the equivalent of a laugh? I mean, it's not quite a laugh, but I've heard dogs make some sounds that approximate.
Yeah, again, this is just talking about imitating humans. I mean, dogs can be happy and give out joy that would be approximate to a laugh. But I have also heard dogs who form words with their mouth. You know, I mean, they actually speak.
I've heard it myself.
Yeah, I mean, they actually speak. I've had them say things to me out loud because they try to form it with it, because they hear it enough from us, and so they form it with their mouth. But again, you can get so much more out of them telepathically, because there's a lot more going on than the few little words they can imitate.
It is still amazing to hear. I mean, I've had people play me tapes on the air. It's absolutely amazing. All right, Penelope, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. Good break for you. Lots and lots of questions. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM from the cold, high desert.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. Listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from January 17th, 2002.
And we are privileged to have the world's premier animal communicator with us here tonight, Penelope Smith. All animal communicators refer to her. And so we have been referred to her, and she's here tonight, and we're going to ask a million different questions about animals. What they think. Stay right there. Here's a couple of tough ones for you, Penelope. Are animals self-aware?
Yes.
They are?
Yes. And again, this is something, when you tune into them, you start to see what their awareness is. And when people talk about self-awareness, are they aware that they exist? Yes. And are they aware that they're individuals? Yes. Do they have a connection, aware of their connection with the rest of the world? Yes. And each one perceives individually, both by species and by individual. They have different ways of looking at the world, just as we do. But I would definitely say, from all my experience with talking to all kinds of animals, that they are aware of themselves.
That's really important. Do you then, by extension... I mean, as I said, to me, every one of my cats is as individual as a snowflake in personality. They're totally different, completely different. I mean, just once you get to know them, they're as different as day and night in their personalities. And so if they have self-awareness and they have personalities and they feel emotions, love, fright, hate, I suppose, you know, all kinds of ranges of emotions, just like human beings, then why should we not conclude they have souls?
Well, they are. They are spiritual beings. They have souls, definitely. That's my experience. When you treat them that way, they respond to you in a whole different way than when you look at them as objects. And that's the success I've had in the communication, is the animals respond to being treated as who they are, which is spiritual beings or souls.
But if they have souls, and they are self-aware, and they have all these emotions, then spiritually, what difference is there between them and us?
Well, different beings choose different experiences. It's a different experience to be a cat and a dog and a human, and it's different to be different kinds of humans in different cultures. This is my perception, my experience, is that we are spiritual beings who come in and choose our experience according to what is our purpose, what we're traveling along on the path, what kind of experience we want in our lives. And this goes into the reincarnation and the life-to-life, that we can live in many different forms and many different experiences, and it's all quite wonderful, and what the animals give is just as valuable in the whole web of life as what humans give. We all give our particular function, our particular qualities to each other, and it makes this world function.
All right. Well, then here's a tale of two cats. How different would they be? My cat, which stays inside, our cats are inside cats. We don't let coyotes eat them and things crush them. So we keep them safe inside, all the shots up and all the rest of it. And they seem extremely happy, and they are bonded to us, no question. Now, cat number two, I was in Bangkok a few years ago. And for the most part, in Bangkok, cats are trying to avoid the street vendors who put them in pots and cook them, and people who eat them. I mean, you go out on the street in Bangkok and you get cat anywhere.
Yeah.
Cat is food there. Now, it would seem to me that a cat there, you know, if a cat has a lot of self-awareness and it understands self, does it become like the deer when it's in Bangkok? Does it know that its role is entirely different? It is not necessarily friend human, or it's going to be, it would probably consider humans as, you know, something that would cook them.
As predators, yeah.
Yeah, predators.
Definitely. It's a whole different experience. And again, we get back to beings choosing their experience when they come in, choosing where they're going to be, what form, what country, what experience. And again, that's a whole other metaphysical subject that I have a lot of experience both in counseling humans and animals.
So, yes,
they would have a whole different experience of life.
Do animal sounds absolutely mean things? They certainly seem to. I mean, a cat has a million different little voices and meows and coos and so forth.
Yes.
And so on. Do all these things mean something?
Well, they express themselves through their sounds, and every animal, all different kinds of animals, have different languages, different ways of expressing through sounds, through movements, through dances. So, yes, you could track different meanings, but different animals will, especially domesticated animals, develop different ways of expressing themselves than other animals of their same kind in different places. So they may have the same gesture, and it might mean something else than some other cat.
Okay, what is this cat saying? That's always what I thought was, damn it, get off my tail. That's what that sounds like, isn't it?
It sure does.
Yeah, okay. Do animals have any sense of anything that lies beyond life.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Now, my experience with animals, and again, they have different awarenesses and different ways of expressing their intelligence, but all of the animals are aware of themselves as spiritual beings who are also being dogs, cats, frogs, whatever they are. They also are aware of death. They accept death as a part of life and that they're going to go on. They're aware of themselves when they go on beyond death. You can communicate with them. And they have an innate awareness. This is something, again, that we sort of are socialized out of. And humans also have the choice to forget who they are, have the mental complexity to get lost in, where animals just don't forget who they are. They always stay grounded in their own experience as spiritual beings living in a particular form and totally enjoying their form and totally enjoying their life as best as they can.
Do they share a fear of death with us? I mean, most humans do have a fear of death.
I would say that they want to survive, and they will try to protect themselves and live, but they don't want to be hurt. But as far as accepting death as part of life, animals have a real acceptance, just like that rabbit I talked to you about.
Right.
But domesticated animals get all wrapped up in their people and start to go, oh dear, I can't die because my person is feeling sad and I better hang on even though it hurts. And they get all wrapped up in human thinking.
Yeah.
Generally, animals will like to die very peacefully and quietly, or often they'll go off by themselves, or they accept it, and they don't fight it unless, of course, they're, you know, having to take care of a person and they're being torn by their person's feelings. But generally, animals will, it's not like they want to die, like they're going, oh, whoopee, death, but they accept it as part of the natural cycle. They come in, they live the best way they can, enjoy life with all their senses, and then they go, okay, well, I'm going to be departing, but they're also aware that they go on.
They're also empaths. Now,
yep.
Our cats, both with my wife and myself, all four of our cats, they know when we're sick.
Mm-hmm.
They know for sure when we're sick, and they come and they sit on your lap and they comfort you and they stay very close, and they know you're sick.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's no question about it. They know you're sick.
Can I tell you a story about that that I was very moved by? I had foot surgery, and it was excruciatingly painful. And one of my cats, I had four cats at the time also, and one of my cats, she did not like high-pitched sounds. She didn't even like whistles. And I was howling. I was crying so hard. I hurt so bad. And she came up on my chest, and she, who did not like to be even near a little squeak, she patted my tears on my face and licked my face. And then my dog came running in and heard me crying, came over to me and said, okay, I know what would cheer you up. You need a walk. And I laughed so hard because, of course, he was giving me his solution for cheering up, which is a walk, which
take
I couldn't
walk,
do.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
But it was the same empathy that you're talking about. It's a deep, deep experience of your pain and wanting to comfort you. They're exquisitely sensitive to your feelings.
Is it fair to say, in your communication with animals, particularly domestic animals, that they love us the way we love them? Or is their sense of connection with us entirely alien?
Okay, it's not entirely alien. It's neither. It's a mixture of both of those things. First of all, animals gravitate to you, just like that black cat you said who jumped on you and said, I'm going home with you, you're my people.
Yeah, that's right.
Recognizing your energy, recognizing a soul connection, recognizing a bond, a heart, emotional feeling.
Something. Yeah.
And so, yeah, all of it. And so animals feel their own feelings. They have their own ways of loving. There's some animals that are very, very loving, very expressive, very wanting to be close to people. And there's other animals that are not, that want a certain amount of touch and a certain amount of distance.
And that's right, and distance. But there are some that, you have to believe they love you as you love them. That it
yes.
really is pretty much the same emotion.
A deep love. Oh, yes, I see what you're saying in the same way, with that deep emotion, yes.
Right.
Yes, but again, they make their choice how they want to love. It isn't just because you love them that they love you. Oftentimes they love you when you don't even care about them or even care about yourself. Animals will take care of you and love you, which is why it's so healing for many people to be around animals, because they give so much love even to people who don't even love themselves.
That's scientific fact.
Mm-hmm.
Merle in Walnut Creek, California. When a cat suddenly starts staring at something intently or sees something that we cannot see, is this cat seeing something in another dimension or at another frequency that we cannot fathom? Because surely it does seem like that cat is either suddenly switched on the imagination switch and sees a mouse going across the floor that we can't see, or really does see something in some spectrum we can't see.
Yeah.
Which is it?
It's the seeing things in another spectrum, in another dimension.
Uh-huh.
First of all, they're extremely sensitive to energies and spirits. So they can see projections of thoughts, too. Like when you're talking about a mouse, if the mouse is thinking about going across the floor, or even in other dimensions, beings, spirits. You'll see cats, dogs staring in corners. They're seeing things that we may not be able to see unless we tune in also. They're extremely sensitive energetically, and they're telepathic. They're all telepathic with you, with each other. They get each other's thoughts and feelings, and they can get that of disembodied beings also.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're really sensitive. They're quite amazing. You learn from talking to each animal, you learn amazing things about the universe. Whole different ways of looking at the universe and exquisite sensitivity.
If all of this is true, Penelope, then what's wrong with the way we handle animals now on the planet? What's wrong?
Well, this is what we've lost. We've lost our birthright, our deep connection, and this is what many, many people are turning back to. Without being telepathically in touch, in other words, feeling what the animals feel and regarding them as fellow beings, we then destroy the earth and ourselves. And it's absolutely imperative, and that's one of the main reasons I do what I do, it's absolutely imperative that people reconnect and understand deeply and feel deeply this part of themselves that's been trampled out of them in our culture. So that we return to a respect for the animals, the plants, the earth, and ourselves, and regard each other with tender, loving care.
Are you a vegetarian?
My body does not thrive well on a complete vegetarian diet, and since my body is my closest animal friend, I listen to it. And it tells me what I need to eat.
You like a burger every now and then.
Every now and then my body asks for meat. It's seldom.
Good for you.
Yeah, but I always give my body what it needs.
Good for you.
And I honor the animals and thank them wholeheartedly. At the same time, I've attempted for many years to be vegetarian by, you know, sort of force against my body's nature. And I didn't thrive real well, and
No, I think it's rational. I think you have a rational attitude about it.
Well, it's what works. It's what works for my body, and it's how it thrives. It's just like I would feed my dog and cat what they need in order to thrive. I feed my own human animal form what it needs to thrive, and that's all I can do.
Huh.
And I'm pretty much vegetarian, you know, because that works for me most of the time.
But every now and then you need some meat.
Yep.
All right. A person here, Diana, up in Alaska, has a pot-bellied pig that is absolutely, totally an unhappy animal. Grumpy, complaining, not happy, just leading an abysmal life.
Mm.
What advice do you offer such an owner with a pig?
Yeah, it's a matter of tuning in to the pig. You know, I'd have to find out individually what's going on with the pig, whether it's uncomfortable physically, what its complaint is, you know, whether it's not in the right environment or whether it's been mistreated by previous people or whatever's going on. So I can't give sort of blanket advice. I'd have to actually tune into the pig, find out who it is, where it is.
Animals are as capable of being grumpy and distempered as people?
Yes. Yes, when they're uncomfortable, when things are hurting emotionally and physically, definitely.
Well, one of my cats that I've had for, 11 years now, you know, he's getting on.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of grumpy. I mean, if you have him out, he's sunning himself on the porch, and you tell him it's time to come in, he goes, he'll hiss at you, and he'll let you know you're a rotten person for doing this. You know, so that's kind of attitude. They have a lot of attitude.
Yeah, well, they have their own particular ways of looking at the world and what their needs are.
Do you know offhand how they see us? Do we appear as big, slow-moving sticks to them?
No.
No?
No, it's a different perception. Now, again, I'm going to give you a general thing for all cats, but at the same time, different ones will perceive slightly differently. First of all, they see quite differently than we do. They perceive, again, energetically. They can definitely see shapes and forms, but it's not the same kind of detail that we see.
They're
focused more on movement, and they don't see the flat detail that we see. So when
you got to hold on. We're at a break point. We've got to take a break, and we'll come right back to exactly what they see.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. Network presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from January 17th, 2002.
And we have the world's premier animal communicator on tonight, Penelope Smith. One thing I've noticed about cats is when you give them a cat treat, if you just gently put the cat treat down and the cat treat nearly matches the color of the rug, they don't even see it. They don't see it. And for a long time, I thought, my cats are going blind. Do you think he's blind, honey? We asked that question a couple times. No, they're not blind. It's just that they don't see the distinction very well. Now, on the other hand, if you put a cat treat down in an area where there's a great contrast, they see it instantly. Or, better yet, if you toss the cat treat in their direction, they see it bouncing, and they're on it in a flash. We'll be back more or less in a flash. Maybe I should have said we'll be back with a crash. Penelope Smith once again, and we're talking about what cats see. And what they don't see, and how they see us most especially. If we could look through their eyes at us, what would we see?
You would see a body that doesn't look so distinct as how we see it, and they aren't using only their sight to see you. They're perceiving your energy, your feelings, your smell, your touch, your taste.
Right.
Everything all together. So it's a more of a complete sensing rather than, see, we're very visual. We're very focused visually. And while a cat has good vision for movement, it doesn't have the same kind of vision we have. So they have a whole different energetic sense. And all animals are very tuned in energetically. So they can spot you by your energy.
Now, is that true of dogs, too?
Mm-hmm.
It is. So,
well, dogs have a different vision than cats. And dogs generally, except for the sighthounds, have very poor vision.
Really? Not as good as a cat?
No. It's different from our point of view. It's different.
Different, yeah.
It's quite different. And fuzzy. You know, again, but if you look through different dogs' eyes, you'll see different kinds of vision, different grades.
I wonder if they could manufacture some glasses for a cat that would essentially convert a cat's world into a human's world, vision-wise. I wonder if that could be done.
I don't know. Not my field.
But it's an interesting idea, isn't it? In other words, something that would allow a cat to see the world as we see it.
Mm-hmm.
Or, even just as interestingly, to allow us to see the world as the cat would see it. Yes.
Yeah. I think it would be very hard for them to function efficiently as predators, and also they have the incredible night vision, too, that we don't have.
Oh, yes. You mentioned dangerous animals. And whether, you know, it's curious to me whether we can communicate with really dangerous animals. Now, my wife and I had a chance to go to East Africa on safari, and we got really close to some lions. I mean, really, in my opinion, way too close. And the only thing that was coming from me was absolute, unadulterated fear. You know, and the guy in the Jeep was saying, look, don't be alarmed if it charges the Jeep. This lion doesn't like me and charges the Jeep every now and then. I'm thinking, great, doesn't like you.
Just what you need.
And so the only thing coming from me was fear. But if you were suddenly to encounter a wild, really dangerous animal in the wild, what could you do if you could get past the fear?
Well, I would take a deep breath, first of all, in myself, and acknowledge my fear, because obviously that's quite natural if you're startled by a dangerous animal, and then communicate in peace. What the Native Americans always said is just communicate that you come in peace. The animals get your intention. Now, if you're in between a grizzly bear's mother and her cub, she's not going to listen to you very much.
No.
So it's a very dangerous situation. But I'll give you an example of something I have experienced. I was in a park in Los Angeles with my dogs, and they were running ahead of me, and they started barking, and I realized there was a rattlesnake there, and the rattlesnake was coiled and ready to strike, and I told one of my dogs to come, and he came, but my other was a puppy, and she's less than a year old, and she's leaping around the rattlesnake.
Dumb.
And she wouldn't listen to me, and I knew if I put my hand out there to grab her collar, I could get struck by
absolutely
the rattlesnake.
Yes.
So I said to the rattlesnake telepathically, not out loud, I just communicated, I want to get my dog away from you. I don't want to hurt you. I'm going to reach for my dog so she doesn't hurt you. I'm going to pull her away, and I want you to go away. Know that I will not hurt you. So this all happened very quickly, and I just knew that the rattlesnake got what I said, and I reached for my dog's collar, which, of course, she was very close to the rattlesnake. The rattlesnake uncoiled, stopped rattling, and moved away as I grabbed my dog.
Hmm.
So that was my experience. I can't say, you know, that I have an experience with polar bears or, you know, great white sharks in the water or something.
You might not want to communicate. Look, I fully understand I'm part of the food chain.
Exactly.
And, okay. That they would understand. All right. What?
But I have had experience with other animals and that are, you know, not going to eat me, but that could be dangerous and hurt me, and found that if you go calmly and just talk to them and tell them your intention and then keep your word, they listen. They don't want to interact with you in a painful way. They're just trying to protect themselves.
What this is going to be another hard one. What do animals think of being fixed? Now, you know, I understand there's a big social movement all across America to have your animals fixed because they're out of control, and we don't want to see them in the chambers and getting killed and all of that sort of thing. But this is a different question. I mean, when they're fixed, when they lose their little manhood or their female plumbing or whatever, how do they take that?
Well, first of all, They come here, and I've had a lot of experience with animals in this. They come here to be with us. Most domesticated animals, the dogs and the cats, come to live with us in a harmonious way as best as they can.
Right.
So when you explain to them that they won't be running around the neighborhood mating, and this will enable them to be close to you, and they won't be spraying the house, which isn't going to do your relations very well with them, generally animals go great, whatever it takes to live with you. Now, obviously, an operation is an operation, and it's a painful thing, but obviously the way it's done by veterinarians now, it's very, you know, easy operation, done well, especially when they're young. And I just explain to the animals what's going to happen, that the purpose of it is, you know, so they won't have babies, or they won't wander, or they won't get hit by cars or hurt by other cats.
Mm.
And they're generally really accepting of it and grateful.
Well, that's interesting, because that argument would not work on me.
It's a whole different situation.
Is it really, though? I guess it is.
Yeah, it is. It's a whole different situation. Because, see, domesticated animals live in a whole different setup than their wild counterparts. And their wild counterparts come in season usually a certain time of year. And, you know, they're predated upon, and they have to make babies. And our animals don't. And so they live, and they pick up this, what's going on. They pick up that they don't need to make babies, that they don't need to.
They really do, huh?
Yes, yes.
Because and you would think
they
that
they have
would
an awareness of what their situation is. And, in fact, many domesticated animals do not want to have babies. They don't want to. They want to focus on their service, their task, their life, their familyhood with their people.
Yes, but, gosh, our purpose is to be fruitful and multiply. It says so right there in the Bible. And, you know, I'm sure that instinctually animals
must have population control, too.
Well, yes, that's a very good point. But a separate point. In other words, with animals, you would think, though, that there would be an instinctual urge to reproduce, you know, put there just by nature.
Yes, and they have their choices. They choose, and again, this is where the spirit comes in. These particular animals choose to be with people. They don't choose to live a wild life and just reproduce. When you tell a wild cat who's had 5 litters in a row that you're catching her in order to help her so she can live and doesn't have to die having babies, you know, one set after the other and not being fed well, generally with that, they will let you spay them. I've worked with any number of wild cats and told them what's going to happen, and of course that they'll be handled well and then they'll be released if that's what they want. They're relieved. And again, it depends on the individual case. You know, I've had people who have said, oh, I want my dog to have babies. They're a breeding dog. I want them. And the dog is going, I don't want to have babies. That isn't what I came here for. You know? And so, yes, certain cases you can have a dog unneutered, or you can have a cat unneutered and still live with them. But a lot of times you can't. Or, again, it's the population control. Or they can't live as well with
but
you.
But you're telling
the cat
me, you really are telling me now that mm-hmm. there are some cats that essentially say to themselves, and some humans do, hey, I don't want to change diapers in the case of humans, or I don't want something making all my little breasties saggy, or I don't want to go through this. I choose not to reproduce.
They're choosing to focus on being with their people. I've had any number of animals say, no, this isn't part of my purpose. So they're happy to be spayed and neutered. Again, people have a lot of feelings about it, and people project. I find it particularly with men. They go, oh, my gosh, their malehood, like you mentioned, their manhood.
That's right.
Well, they're not men, you know?
Well,
you know, and they have to live in a certain way where they can live harmoniously. You know how tomcats end up getting killed or hurt or beaten up, and of course they spray in your house and you can't have them inside.
But they also go out and have fun wild nights.
Well,
that's what's at stake here when you're talking about manhood. Fun wild nights versus getting fat and lying in front of the TV.
You're projecting human reality.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right. Matt in Rock Island, Illinois asks, do animals, and it's a good one, Do they harbor resentment toward humans? Do they carry grudges?
Generally, again, individual cases are different. When animals have been really abused, oftentimes they don't want anything to do with people. But most of the time, most animals will let go. Say a person does something out of anger, an animal will be over it pretty soon if they realize, when they realize, which they usually, you know, get their people's feelings pretty fast, that the person isn't going to do it again, and they're over it. But if a person, if an animal knows they're going to get abused again and again, I don't generally find them holding, like, heavy grudges, like they're going to kill a person or something like that, but they don't want it to happen again, and they certainly hurt from it, and they certainly have trauma from it.
Penelope, let me try this one. If your cat is angry with you, are they capable of anger, by the way?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Definitely.
If your cat is angry at you, and you leave the house, is a cat capable of thinking to this degree that, aha, I know where a favorite thing of this person's is, and I know how to totally wreck it before they get home? Now, I've seen this happen to me, so I'm just asking, you know, it could, of course, be coincidence or... something or another, but cats do this. They find your favorite thing and they rip it up.
Well, let me just tell you how I would express it from having heard cats communicate about it and about their feelings.
Okay.
It's the way you express it, like you say, oh, they think about it and go, I'm going to tear this up. Well, they might be mad because of whatever situation occurred that you didn't, you know, do something with them, or they feel ignored, or whatever it is.
Right.
And they may express it on your things, because that's a direct way of letting you know, because you're not listening to them, that they're unhappy. So, yes, they can do that. I have definitely experienced that from different animals. If you listen to them, if you acknowledge them, you can short-circuit all that behavior. And you don't have to have it happen. When the cat gets their needs met, or you just acknowledge whatever's going on with them, they don't have to dramatize, but they're just trying to get across to you. They're just trying to get across that something is not working for them.
How unhappy can a pet get when you leave the house? I mean, there are some pets.
Everybody's different. You know, it depends on them, you know. I mean, if you communicate well about what's going on, if they have their needs met, if they get enough exercise, depends, you know, dogs, cats, whoever, everybody's different. You know, what is the situation? You know, for example, I go out of town often, and when I first started going out of town, my young cats, I mean, they didn't like it. They didn't like that I left, but I told them, okay, I'm going to be gone for a certain amount of time, and I want you to stay in touch with me, and I'm going to stay in touch with you, and I want you to help me energetically with my work. So they felt united with me and didn't get so pissed off. But if I don't think of them, if I don't stay in touch as well with them, then they can get more like, hey, you ignore us, and not be real happy about it when I get home.
Well,
generally, I stay in tune with them.
When we're packing, you know, getting ready to go somewhere,
mm-hmm.
Our cats get pissed.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not happy campers. They know what's going on.
Of
they
course.
Know we're going away, and they
of
don't
course.
Like it one bit.
Yeah. Well, you can make it better for them by staying in touch, communicating with them, asking them to take care of things for you. Give them something to do. Ask them to take care of the house sitter. Tell them how long you're going to be gone. You know, communicate clearly to them, and then they calm down about it.
Yes.
If they think you're just, you know, going off and not caring about them, that's a whole different thing than if they know what's going on. And believe me, they understand what you're saying. They understand how long you're going to be gone. They track you. They keep in touch spiritually with you, emotionally with you. So if you think about them, stay in touch,
okay.
They do a lot better.
Okay. You're aware, I bet you saw that 2020 piece, didn't you? Well, this was a good one, though, Penelope. They did this experiment. And 2020 put cameras in people's homes, you know, and the pet was home alone,
uh-huh.
the dog typically.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would start the person home from work at a time they would not normally come home.
Right.
Early. They're coming home early. But the animal had no idea could have no idea. And in every single case, Penelope,
they know.
They know the person is on the way home. They know the person's on the way home. They start running to the door.
Yes.
And jumping and waiting and knowing the person's about to walk through that door. That has got to be, that's got to be telepathy.
Yes, it is. And let me tell you, your cats right now know that you're talking to me and that you've mentioned them and they're tracking this and they're going to expect more from you when you get home. Even though you're a great cat person and you love them and you're very respectful, they're now going to expect you to be even more intelligent.
Penelope, I do my program from home. And, you know, if they want my attention, they come to the door and start making noise on it. All right, listen. Tim in Toronto, Canada says, you know, I'm petting my cat. My cat is purring. It's happy. All is right in the world. And then all of a sudden, my cat totally goes berserk and bites me.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here?
What's happening? First of all, this is cats being very sensitive to energy and people not being. Very often this happens with cats, and cats really complain about it, where people just keep stroking and stroking. It actually irritates their nervous system. And people aren't listening. The cat's going, don't do it anymore. And the person is going, is stroking absent-mindedly, and the cats hate that when you do it unconsciously.
I see.
And it arouses their nervous system. It actually feels like, sort of like people get a reaction to chalk on the blackboard, you know, or fingernails on the blackboard when it squeaks. It's like that for a cat, and the cat finally goes, I can't stand it anymore, and then they bite you. But if you notice with a cat, and particularly cats who are real energetic and hypersensitive, you have to notice what's happening with them, and people don't. They go, oh, why did the cat bite me? Well, the cat signaled you telepathically long before, and then energetically, and then they switch their tails. They always tell you before they're going to bite you. They always tell you when it's too much.
It's like, okay, bud, that's a final straw.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, hold on, Penelope, at the top of the hour. Penelope Smith is my guest. She's the world's premier animal communicator, and that's exactly what we're talking about, animals. We'll continue to take fast blast questions, and I'll get phone lines open here coming into this next hour. So if you have a question, it would be a good time to go to the phone. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM, raging through the nighttime.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from January 17th, 2002. Somewhere in Time with Art Bell continues, courtesy of Premier Networks.
Good morning, everybody. The world's premier animal communicator is here, Penelope Smith. By the way, if you're intrigued and you want to know a lot more, then you might want to read her books. And we've got a link on our website to her books. For example, Animal Talk, Interspecies Telepathic Communication, or When Animals Speak, Advanced Interspecies Communication, and an audiobook called Dolphin Talk. So all of that, that's, you've got links on the website. Just follow it. Keep going. And this sounds like something you're going to want to follow up on in some detail. How can you not be fascinated? That's what I'd say. We'll be back in a moment. Did that a bit prematurely, but that's all right. We'll take care of it later. Right now, back to Penelope Smith. And Penelope, here's something that I guess I want to ask. Do dogs and cats like each other, or have they, or in some cases, do they build strong bonds, or do they just most of the time kind of tolerate each other?
Well, again, that's very individual. There's some dogs that and cats that adore each other, that absolutely are best friends, and there's some that just don't like each other at all. So, you know, it varies. I mean, again, you get domesticated animals who have lived with people and each other for years and years and years. They develop all kinds of relationships.
But, you know,
including with rats, with birds, with snakes, with rabbits, all different kinds of domesticated animals that wouldn't socialize in the wild, end up being very good friends and having great relationships in a domesticated situation.
Now, can you recommend that the following experiment be tried? Out where I live, Penelope, we have a lot of wild animals. Coyotes.
Mm.
We have big 20-pound birds that look like they'd pick you up and take you off. You know? I mean, we have really wild animals out here in the desert. And is it possible when you're near one, and occasionally you can be near one, to communicate with it that you want to be near it, that you're not going to harm it, and then sort of sit there and be with that? Will that animal agree to be with you for a while?
Yes, that often happens. Many people have this experience. I have this experience all the time with animals, with wild animals. And I regard it as a great honor and privilege that they decide to stay. You know, they know you're, again, they get your intentions, and they'll decide whether they want to or not. Some may have other business to do, and they go, no, not right now.
All right. Oh, yeah, no, but just before we go to the phone, here's one that really should be asked, I suppose. How do animals in zoos feel? Zoos are a different kind of environment, aren't they?
Yeah, and again, this is a mixed question, because you'll find some animals in zoos who were captured from the wilds against their wishes, be very, very unhappy and demonstrate that in the zoo. And then you get some animals who have chosen as spirits to be born in zoos or to be in a situation where they're transferred from place to place. I find that the more the animals are honored for who they are and given space and given more natural conditions, the better that they feel about it. At the same time, there are many animals that will never be happy in zoos. And I don't think that zoos are something that we necessarily should keep long term. I think that we should, you know, eventually evolve out of this so that we live with animals in their natural conditions and honor them as they are. At the same time, zoos now are also serving other functions of helping with endangered species and doing all kinds of work to...
Yes, but as a general rule, if you go to a zoo, is it a sad place from an animal's perspective?
Again, I find it, the general energy when I go to many zoos, to be very difficult to tolerate because many animals are unhappy. However, that's not the case with all animals. So I can find some animals that are okay being there or have chosen that or adapted to it or are ambassadors to people. They regard it as their role and actually are very compatible with people and friendly. And then you get, I've been in zoos where it's just about closing time and the animals are going, yay, all the people are leaving, you know. You know, it's a mixed bag and definitely depends on their situation.
Okay. I want to take some calls. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with Penelope Smith. Hello.
Hi, Art.
Hi there.
This is Roan calling from the Northern Sierra.
Yes, sir.
And this is really a synchronistic lead-in that you guys had, because I have a large cat question for you.
Okay.
I've read... one of your books, Penelope, and I've really, really enjoyed it. I've had a thing all my life with big cats. I've worked in two zoos. I can tell you irrefutably that most of the animals are crazy.
Yeah.
In the zoos, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I've nursed Serengeti, black maned Serengeti cubs back to health from being burned in bars with cigarettes to hear them roar.
Yeah.
Back to where they're somewhat sane. I've had cougars. And I have had experiences in the wild all the time with large cats. For example, I was finishing a PhD in San Francisco, living in Tiburon, and you probably know the area.
Mm-hmm.
And the person I was working for had a large estate there, a big, as most of them are, very large. And I chose not to live on the place with her and had my own camp about a half mile from where she was. And every night I would go to my camp up this cliff face and then about half a mile. And every night after I had been there maybe, I spent 4 or 5 days a week down in Marin doing research at the university there, et cetera, et cetera. And I would sleep there every night, and after the second week, there was a female cougar there at the top of the rise that would walk with me all the way, maybe within 10 feet, all the way to the drop-off to where I stayed, would stay there all night. She would kill, she would make kills within 30 feet of my camp. I would get up in the morning at 8:30 in the morning and go out, and there would be piles of scat 10 and 12 feet in front of me that were that fresh, still steaming. If I missed more than 3 days in a row, she would come up to my office where I had my office and worked on this estate. She was seen 3 times. They thought she was a Great Dane with a long tail. You know, a whole bunch of people saw her. My question to you is, I am planning on getting some acreage further up, maybe 60 acres, and providing a haven for large cats, specifically for cougars and Bengals that are overages and, you know, the unwanted cat phenomena.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what you think the effect on the local cats are going to be, because we have more and more up here. I've run into 4 new cats.
So you're wondering what the effect on the others?
This is what I would recommend to you, since you're so sensitive with the cats and they are so tuned into you, and you're walking the way I was talking about, where you just walk with the wild animals, respect them, and they come to you because they have the choice. So this is what I would recommend you do, is go to the area, sit in a meditative space, get real quiet, and let telepathically just communicate to all the wild cats what's going to happen here and why you're going to be doing what you're doing. When you do that, just feel whatever comes to you. Just, you know, ask the cats to communicate whatever it is that they wish and start to feel it. And you will probably find that with that understanding and with you having asked and given that purpose for what you're doing, that you're going to be helping the cats who have been abused, that you will find a cooperation among the other cats and a harmony that you may not have otherwise.
Okay, here's a really hard one. Richie in San Diego asks, if an animal's very sick and the vet doesn't know why, should that animal be put down or not? And how can one find out from the animal itself what it wants? I've got my own little story, but
Sure. First thing you need to do is to communicate with the animal and ask them what's going on. They often have information that can help a vet to find out what is actually happening. When they first started feeling ill, did they eat some poison? You know, whatever is going on, they can tell you a lot about it. And the vet may not be able to diagnose it as a particular disease, but say you communicated that to, say, a holistic vet who works with acupuncture or homeopathy or other alternative means, they would be able to work with the cat or whoever it is to help them by the symptoms that the cat is presenting, according to what the cat says. I've got a pain, you know, deep in my chest, and it started when I ate this or did that. So you know, there's no question that you can definitely get more information from the animals.
Can you find out if a cat wants to go?
Yes, and you can communicate to them. They will tell you when it is their time, or if they're in such pain that they need some assistance, they would like some assistance with the vet, or if they want to tell you, I just want to be at home and just go quietly, and yeah, they'll tell you when they feel it's their time.
How many vets do you think attempt some level of communication?
I feel like there are many vets now. I mean, over the years, many veterinarians have read my books and use them with the animals. So I know there's a lot of holistic vets, and I think there's more and more vets that see a lot of people communicate with animals and get their communication but aren't recognizing it. They're in tune. They're close to them, or they wouldn't even be in the animal field. And when they start to read the books and learn what telepathic communication is about, they start to develop an ability they already had there and that they were unknowingly using, and then they get better at it. So I actually think that there's more and more. I couldn't give you a percentage. I really haven't done a survey.
Our cat, Abby, the old one, about 12 now, 11 or 12, and Abby suddenly one day fell off the couch. We looked at Abby. Abby was suddenly, instantly sick. And when I say sick, I mean really sick, dying. Mm. And what happened to Abby was his liver had shut down, totally, completely shut down. And we took Abby to vet number one, who said, no, this almost never can be recovered from at this stage. You're going to have to put your cat down. We both, my wife particularly, said, no, Abby's not ready to go. It's not Abby's time. No way. Mm-hmm. So we drove to Las Vegas, 65-mile drive at about 1,000,000 miles an hour, bawling all the way, you know, with this dying cat in my lap. Oh, God, it was awful. And went to this very special, holistic, wonderful doctor who, over a period of some weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, brought this cat back totally. This cat is now into a totally new life. I mean, it's like it never happened. It got so bad that she had to breathe for him. Mm. You know, he had stopped breathing that bad.
Wow.
The liver turned back on. Boom! Brand new cat, like one of the lives, you know?
Yeah.
And my wife knew it was not Abby's time.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. Obviously wasn't.
Yeah.
Abby actually looks better and has a better time now than ever before, so.
I'm glad she listened to him.
Yeah.
She got it.
Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Penelope Smith. Hello.
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
This is Kat from near San Francisco.
Yes.
A while ago, I took in 5 kittens.
Yes, sir.
I was watching them as they were going through their teenage, and I noticed that the boys were establishing dominance by going through the neck biting and standing over routine. And I thought, oh, gee, cat rules. So I did the same thing to all of them. Now, Penelope, do you approve of following cat rules on raising cats?
Well, what do you mean? You did the same thing to them that they were doing to each other? So you chased your cat down and jumped on top of it?
I grabbed him by the nape of the neck with my teeth.
Yeah.
And went through the standard stances on all of them.
I would never.
Treat me as the alpha male.
Boy, that takes guts. I'll tell you. I don't think I'd clomp down on a cat with my teeth. But all everybody to their own. What do you say to that?
Everybody establishes their own way of communicating with different beings. I can't give you a standard way of communicating. It's what the animals accept, what works.
But would that work? Would that be effective? I mean, if you know,
it depends on the animal. You know, some people try to make these blanket rules, and they go, "Oh, you need to be the alpha dog, and you need to throw your dog on its back and show him," and then the dog becomes traumatized and afraid of you the rest of its life. I don't think you can make these kind of rules. That's the great thing about telepathically communicating. You could find what the animal is thinking, what they want, what works for them, what they respect, how they think about you. And if you start to go into routine behaviors with animals, you end up objectifying them, and they end up having to respond to you in that way, the way you're treating them. They have to work with you.
Right. Gotcha. So it wouldn't be such a good idea, really, then, to get down on their level and observe their rules and be the king. Not good, huh?
I wouldn't recommend this as a general procedure.
Yeah, I wouldn't either, especially the biting critters.
I would go much more for sensitively tuning in, such as you mentioned your wife did.
Uh-huh. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Penelope Smith. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Art.
Yes, sir. Where are you?
This is Brandon from Ashland, Kentucky.
Okay.
And I find it interesting that, well, cats especially, some are very receptive to, like, television and mirrors. But yet others seem like it doesn't even exist.
I was just wondering
if you could expand on that.
Okay.
Yeah, again, they're very individual, have individual perceptions. They decide what aspects, again, we're talking about domesticated cats. They decide what aspects of human environment they want to be involved in. What interests them so much depends on their hookup with their people, too. Sometimes they do things just because their people are doing with them. Everybody's so different. And, I've talked to probably millions of animals by now, and they all look at the world a little bit different way. They're very individual, even though you have commonalities among species.
So we just can't. It's very hard to do any sort of generality.
It's very hard. That's why I say it's great to have the telepathic communication, because you can find straight from the individual. It's like if I try to generalize about humans and I say, you're going to be thinking the same thing, or I should do the same thing with you as I do with other people, no way. You know, and I would say the same with animals, and that's where you get the best results. When you treat them as individuals, you can apply different training, different ways of being with them that work really well for them, and there may be some general things that work, but you don't have to rely on that and go and act like a robot with them.
All right, stay right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. When we get back, I want to ask about dolphins, whether they're really, really, really as smart as a lot of people think they are, just in a different way. They could be actually as smart as we are, it is said by some, but in a different way. That's kind of an eerie thought, if true. We'll ask about it when we get back. Stay right there.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time.
And he could sing a song. His heart in every line.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from January 17th, 2002.
My guest is Penelope Smith, and boy, do I have a good question for her coming right up, and then more of your calls. Because I know you have questions, zillions of questions, just like I do. Meg in Sacramento, California writes, and this is so interesting. She says, look, I am neutral in my feelings about cats. I lean toward avoidance. However, cats seek me out, jump in my lap, rub against my leg, drive me crazy, and this is so, so true. She leans toward avoidance. There are people that come in my house, Penelope, who, they hate cats. I mean, they just absolutely hate cats, and cats love them to death. Mm. Why is that?
Part of it is, again, cats are real sensitive to energy and your feelings. And if you're withdrawing from them, many cats will feel like there's a place where they're going to move into your space and help you to like them. Not only like them, but to get over your aversion to cats, because they feel you pulling in your, it's sort of like creating a vacuum. They feel you almost pulling them in. And that happens with a lot of people where they feel they're kind of resisting the cat, the animals. And it's not just cats, dogs or other animals. The animals will come to them because they want to relate to you.
Even though they don't get the sense that the person is radiating, get this furry thing away from me.
They get the, whatever it is the person is actually radiating, which a lot of times is not so much, I don't want this cat in my space, but then I'm afraid. And often animals who are sympathetic will actually try to calm the person down, will try to soothe them, will work with them.
Fascinating. All right.
And different animals have different responses. Some animals will stay away from a person who has that much fear, and others will try to soothe them.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Penelope Smith. Hello.
Yes, how do you do, Art? Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Penelope, your views are just wonderful, and they come in perfect timing with two books that I'm reading. And I wondered, one of my questions was if you were familiar with the books by J. Allen Boone?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, okay. Okay, it's just wonderful. And
oh, definitely. I highly recommend them.
It's both, the books are both hilarious and awesome at the same time.
Yeah, they're classics, Kinship with All Life.
Yes, yes.
They're just classics on the subject of telepathic communication with animals.
Well, I lived in a very wild area on the balmy south shore of Hood Canal near Seattle. Had a lot of wild critters that I'm befriending. As a child, I had them as playmates in Ohio in the forest before I went to school, and I was convinced I couldn't share pictures with them like I was, and I'm trying to reestablish that contact. Do you have any good suggestions?
Just let them know. Get real quiet. Sit very quietly and let the animals know. They'll get your messages that you would like to be close to them, that you would like to have a good connection, and soon you'll see they'll start coming to you. You can't, you know, push on them or put a lot of energy out to them. Simply sit quietly and let yourself receive them into your space, and they will come.
Well, I thought I was winning for a while until it came to Blue Jays. And it just, I was having dozens of them here, and I couldn't sleep because of their noise, and it was they just would not listen.
Yeah, well, that happens. I guess they can choose not to listen to you, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. They're not going to always agree with you or take a command.
Exactly.
Alan in Hollywood, California, asks the following. I've thought about this from time to time. He says, look, what about bugs? I mean, you pull out the fly swatter and whack. Now, am I going to have to answer for all of those deaths?
There's a whole different way to live with smaller animals than people are accustomed to being socialized into thinking. You can actually live in real harmony with them and not create a war between you and them. And many people have found that they can communicate with bees and flies and wasps and ants and establish a whole different relationship.
Don't bother me, I won't bother you kind of thing.
Well, not even that. You can have a really good relationship. I'll give you a little story. I was sitting out in the woods meditating, and this fly landed on my hand, and it tickled as the fly was walking across my hand. So I said to the fly, okay, if you can tickle me and walk on my hand, then you've got to let me touch you. And the fly kind of went, whoa, as I was communicating with it, and I stroked the fly, and the fly flew away, and I thought, well, that's it. And the fly came back again. I said, okay, you tickle me, I stroke you. And we did this for like 7 times with the fly going back and forth until he was in quite a state of ecstasy. We were in very deep communion with each other, and he went off, and it was like,
whoops,
he was thinking, what am I going to tell? The other flies are not going to believe me.
That's an incredible story. That's really true. You swear that's true?
Definitely true. And it's interesting. I told that story at a workshop, and this man was sitting in the back. We were outside, and he was very skeptical. He had just come along because his wife wanted to do the course. And he came up to me at break. He says, you know, I didn't believe you at all when you said that. I thought that was just, you know, baloney. And so I said, okay, flies, if you can understand me, somebody come along and sit on my hand and let me pet you, like Penelope said she did with him. And this fly landed on his hand, and he petted him again and again. He did the same thing. He says, I couldn't believe that this was true, and there it happened to me.
Well, I'm going to try it.
Yeah.
I will try it.
Insects are amazing, and they're very attentive. Spiders, insects are very, very attentive and can make extraordinary companions on the earth.
All right. You're on the air with Penelope. Hi there. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, sir. Hi.
Hi, Eric. I wanted to ask you a question, ma'am. I got a few cats myself, and I'm in Stockbridge, Georgia, by the way. But I wanted to ask you, are cats naturally destructive? And I'll tell you the reason why is because I've got some, and it seems like a couple of them really like to spray or did before I got them neutered. And it would seem like no matter what I brought home, it could be a videotape, it could be a new TV set, a vacuum cleaner, whatever. They just picked everything that I had, and I had to put it up so they would not spray on it. What is the chances of, once they are neutered, to not having them continue to
Well, the
do
best
that?
Thing is to get them neutered before they start to practice, because this
is
very instinctual for them to mark territory. And once they're, often cats, when they are tomcats and are bonded to you, they will spray on your things actually more. They're actually creating the space sort of safe for you. And so it isn't a matter of being naturally destructive. It's a matter of actually making it safe. And then you get cats who spray also because they feel they need sort of a comfort. And when they make that space, they feel more comfortable, like the space is theirs. So the best thing, of course, is to get them neutered early. And then you can also communicate to them about it. But you have to listen first and find out what their reason is. What is it that they're doing? But these are some of the things that I've discovered from cats that they do, and why they spray
Penelope,
a lot.
I cannot remember the name of the movie, but there was a man who went into the wild and studied, I guess, how, I think it was wolves or something, how they live, and he ate mice and all that stuff. And he went around and sprayed himself. He put a big circle of human spray around his camp. Now, what would that do?
Well, what that would do is, I mean, he's acting like the wolves, and they would recognize his scent and that he was making territory like them. So they'd go, okay, well, this guy's making territory like we do.
So that would have worked. They would respect that territory?
Well, they would recognize it, that he was there. What do you mean by respect it? Would they come into it? It would depend on them, you know, what purpose they had and whether it was their territory first or whatever. He was just trying to get in touch
that he staked out a non-previously staked out territory. Would they respect it and generally?
I'd have to find out by communicating with the wolves.
All right.
Again, different things happen in different situations. Animals make individual decisions. Again, if you go just by following their habits and doing instinctual things, you don't always get it. You know, we think we can act like them and follow their rules. They know you're human. They know you operate in a different way. They check you out. You don't have to act like another animal. Act like a human and communicate to them as a fellow being who happens to be a human, and they'll respect you. I mean, he didn't need to do that, but that was his experiment. That's how he was communicating. You could communicate it to the wolves in a different way, that you were there and what place you wanted as your own.
Gotcha. First time caller line, you're on the air with Penelope Smith. Hello.
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 Hi, Art. Hi, Penelope.
Hi.
I have at home two cats, a male and a female, and the male is about 2 years old, and I swear he talks to me. I can only understand one word that he says, and it only happens when I'm in bed and he thinks it's time for me to wake up.
Sir, what is the word?
Hello.
Just hold it right there, sir. Penelope, let's talk about this for a second.
It's very common.
My wife
very
swears.
Common.
She swears, Penelope, that her cat has come up to her in the morning and whispered in her ear.
Mm-hmm. And I get reports from all kinds of people, and the animals, again, will attempt to communicate to you in whatever way they can, and sometimes will try to form human language and will manage it. But, you know, oftentimes, if people will just listen to them, then the animals don't have to go through such great gyrations, but they enjoy it anyway. They live with you, so they enjoy mimicking your language, too, as best as they can. Again, they only have a certain amount of ability to do that.
All right. Penelope, as best you're able to judge from all the communication you have done, we hear an awful lot about dolphins,
uh-huh.
Right? How smart, how intelligent, by our measure, I guess, are dolphins, really?
Well, again, people judge intelligence by how close it resembles human behavior and what people can understand.
Right.
And so by that standard, dolphins are amazing. I swim with dolphins. I lead dolphin swims. I lead whale journeys. And the dolphins and the whales are some of the most evolved on a physical and spiritual level beings on this planet. And they have incredible abilities to interact both with each other and with people, and they want to interact with people. So, again, they express their intelligence in ways that we can relate to more because they are very social with us. And they are very evolved beings, again, physiologically and emotionally and spiritually.
So that's it's true then. They are one of the more evolved beings on Earth.
Yes, and in terms of their ability to also bring joy and love to other beings, they're quite astounding, actually. When you're with them and you go into a meditative space with them, and again, I take people into the ocean with them, you know, in the Bahamas and Hawaii and different places, and when you go into their space and you communicate with them, they have such a frequency of love that they project with you. People experience incredible states with the dolphins and the whales, and the whales are another whole step in evolution. The dolphins are like the messengers of the whales, and the whales are just some of the greatest teachers on this planet.
Well,
and it is amazing to be with them. It is one of those profound things to experience their energy. I would say if we're going to protect any beings on this planet, we should protect our oceans, our whales, and do everything we can because they give so much to us.
Well, I was just going to say, should our entire attitude about dolphins and whales be changed? Should we just have a whole new way of thinking about them?
I would say about all animals. You know, frankly, I regard all animals as our teachers. All animals deserve respect. And the dolphins and the whales have a particular holy, sacred connection with us that is ancient. They care about us. They want us to evolve. They want us to live well. They deliberately beach themselves in places where people will see them so that people wake up. They're interested in our evolution. They're amazing beings.
Back up a little bit. Why do they beach themselves?
Some of the reasons that they beach themselves in certain areas when they are suffering from diseases from pollution or the low-frequency sonar, the different sounds that are being projected into the ocean, is they are trying to communicate, and they communicate this to me. They go way out of their way to go on beaches where people will see them in order to communicate what's happening in the oceans, in order to communicate that we're hurting our environment, we're hurting ourselves, we're hurting the whales, and we need to change. And they do this with great love and great intention and deliberation. They have councils out there and decide how they're going to reach people. That's, you know, whales like Humphrey that went up the Sacramento River. Believe me, that was all intentional to reach lots and lots of people. They deliberately tried to reach mass levels of people. They're incredibly conscious beings.
That's something to seriously think about. Wildcard line.
Absolutely.
One call I think we have time for. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Penelope Smith. Hello.
Hi, Art. Hi, Penelope. I have two cats, a male and a female, and they hate each other's guts. I don't know what to do. They're brother and sister. When they were babies, they used to clean each other and sleep together, and now they just, you know, stay away from each other and fight for my attention.
Yeah.
Over each other.
Now, it's a good point. I mean, is it possible that two animals, like two cats, could grow to, I mean, humans do it.
To not want to be in each other's space.
Yeah, yeah, they hate each other's guts.
Yeah, and it isn't so much, again, we put a real heavy emphasis on that, hate each other's guts. A lot of times they just have different needs, and if those needs can be met, sometimes some cat will want to have more space or want to have more quiet, or there will be some situation where the person has injected a lot of energy into the cats, and now the cats react to each other in fighting over the person. So there's usually it's a little more complex than, oh, they just started to hate each other. There's some need that wasn't met or something that could be changed about the situation or understood better, and then they can get along, or maybe not. You know, maybe they'll need to live in different areas.
Yeah, that's where I was going. In other words, could there be, I mean, like, I hate you so much, I wish your paws were in hot water, you know, whatever. Something like that. I mean, just really, I mean, humans are certainly capable of it, so I guess the question is...
They can definitely dislike each other intensely, yes.
That was the question. What would you recommend if somebody were to get one of your books? Which first book should they begin with?
Animal Talk is the basic book, and we'll give people the basics on how to communicate with animals. And then I have also a whole series of audio tapes. It's on my website, all the audio tapes and videotapes. All these things are real helpful for people to open up to their own ability that's within them and learn how to get more sensitive and get the animals' messages and feelings.
Well, we've got all the links there. They can follow them. What
great.
A joy it has been to have you on the air.
I've totally enjoyed it.
I've been waiting a long time for you. Penelope, thank you so much. And come back. Will you come back?
Okay, sounds good. It was fun.
Good night.
Good night.
See you for Open Lines tomorrow night. For tonight, from the High Desert, I'm Art Bell. Ta-ta.